A very happy Friday to each of you. And I hope that you are going to have a great Lord's Day this weekend with your brothers and sisters in Christ at your home congregation. If you don't have a place, you better go find one. You need a place where you can worship and fellowship and study and serve and be encouraged and be an encourager and to praise and pray together with all these folks. That's part of the Christian lifestyle. And so if you don't have a place where you're comfortable and secure doing all those things, you need to go out and find one. And if you're actively looking and you're within driving distance of the Elkhart East building, please come check us out as a potential place that you could call your home church. Fridays, I also say thank you to those of you who are supporting Into the Word financially. Anyone that would like to assist, all you have to do is write down the contact information you'll hear at the end of today's program. Then you can send your one-time or ongoing gift of any amount to that address. It'll be applied to keeping this program on the radio. We are in Exodus chapter number 3, the dramatic commissioning of the premier prophet of the Israeli nation, Moses. Moses is the perfect person to lead the Israelis out of Egypt and to the promised land. He is a man of both worlds. He was raised as an Egyptian. He knows the Egyptian political machine inside and out. He knows its culture. He speaks fluently the Egyptian language, as well as being a man of the Israelis, speaking Hebrew flawlessly, being raised by a Hebrew mother and father in his earliest years, knowing the stories that he later writes down in the book of Genesis. And so he thought, when he was about 40 years old, that was his calling in life, to take his position and use it to defend the Israelis against the abuses of slavery and get them free. But he jumped the gun. And in the process, he had committed what we would call manslaughter, the accidental killing of someone. And when that became known to the Egyptian authorities, Moses fled to a non-extradition country, as we would also say today, the region of Midian, across the Sinai Peninsula from Egypt and south of the land of Canaan, where Egypt had some dealings. Midian is to the southeast of the bottom portion of the Dead Sea, the south end of the Dead Sea, and it's immediately north and east of the northern part of the Gulf of Aqaba. It's desert. It's on the edge of the great highway, the trade route that comes out of Egypt and heads for Mesopotamia. But it's a good place to disappear. And that's exactly what he did. 40 years he's lived here and been a shepherd, taking care of sheep that will eventually, most of them, be used in ceremonies for forgiveness, for appeals to God, because his father-in-law is a priest. His title is Ruel, which has to do with the shepherd of God or the friend of God. And so Moses has moved on. And then this event occurs. 1457, I believe, B.C., is the chronological time. It's the year after Hatshepsut has died. the woman who was in charge whenever Moses committed his manslaughter. Chapter 3, now Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian, and he led his flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And I already told you, I think the Horeb, or Mount Sinai that we're talking about, is likely located in the wilderness of Rum. I think it's R-U-M or R-A-M. And it's in the south part of the kingdom of Jordan. And I believe the highest mountain of Jordan is located in this wilderness. And nearby is a big, flat, open area. The perfect place for an out-of-way meeting between the God of Israel and the Israeli people coming out of Egypt. So Moses is there grazing the flock of his father-in-law, probably as he had done many, many times before. But then verse 2, an angel of he who is appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of the bush. And I've been developing with you the idea that the messenger here, the angel of the Lord, is actually a reference to a physical, visual manifestation of the Holy Spirit. And it's not too far afield from what happens with the manifestation of the Holy Spirit on the day of Pentecost. Fire appears and then splits up and divides upon the 12 apostles. But here is God's presence in this bush, and Moses sees it. He looked, and behold, the bush was burning, yet it was not consumed. And so Moses said, I'm going to turn aside to see this great sight. Why is this bush not being burned? And then when he who is saw that he turned aside to see, God said to him out of the bush, Moshe, Moshe, his Hebrew name, his special name, meaning being drawn out of the water. And he said, here I am. And then he said, do not come near, meaning stop where you're at. Now later, Moses will also give a God command to the Israeli people to stop and not come any closer to Mount Sinai than a certain indicated line. And so God is apparently already setting that up here for Moses. Do not come near. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. And that becomes a traditional acknowledgement that you need to have man-made material out of the way when you are in connection with the God of the universe, when you're in close connection to the God of the universe. So the priests of the Israelis worshiped barefoot so that their feet were in direct connection with creation, not man-made sandals. When Israeli men prayed, they prayed bareheaded so that there was nothing man-made between their head and the head of them, God, the creator of the universe. The Apostle Paul mentions this reasoning in his first letter to the Corinthians. And so here is Moses being commissioned by God. Verse 6, God said to him, I am the God of your father. So that'd be Amram, the God of Abraham, the God of Yitzhak, the God of Yaakov. So that's the great patriarchs of promise. God called Abraham out of Ur of the Chaldees, and he responded in faith. God put the blessings of Abraham onto the child of promise, Yitzhak, and he became a man of faith. And God dealt with the heel grabber Jacob and turned him into the faithful man who has struggled with God and survived, Yisrael. And so he becomes the namesake for the whole tribal family that Moses is part of. And here he is. Here is God talking to Moses. This is the first time he's had a supernatural experience. He's 80 years old when he is called to be a prophet. Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. No wonder. I mean, when you think you're in the presence of the holy, righteous God, and you know you've got issues, then you're going to be afraid. And so he is face down in the dirt. He who is then said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt, and have heard their cry because of their taskmasters. I know their suffering. And I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey. So God is now going to tell Moses something that perhaps Moses has heard before, because there was a prophecy passed from God to Abraham that was more than likely passed on from Abraham to Isaac and Isaac to Jacob. And Jacob certainly talked about it with Joseph, because Joseph makes reference to it. And that prophecy was this: the Israeli family is going to spend 400 years, four generations, in a country other than the Promised Land. And they will end up being slaves. But at the end of the time, when the sins of the Canaanites in the Promised Land have reached a fever pitch where God has to do something about it, then God was going to take the Israeli people out of that foreign land and bring them back to the Promised Land. And so now we know all the details of that prophecy. The Israelis ended up in Egypt. That's the foreign land. They became slaves there. 430 years have now passed since they arrived. And four long generations have come and gone since that time. And so it's time for them to go back to the Promised Land, a land that is really good, a land that is very roomy for the population of Israel, a land that is prosperous. The idiomatic expression is that it's flowing with milk and honey. So it's got tons of agricultural regions where you can even raise your cattle and have lots and lots of milk and cheese and curds. And there's bees everywhere making honey, but there's also the agricultural honey that comes from things like dates that get rendered into a super sweet liquid. And so that is the place that God intends to take them, to the place of the Canaanites. And then there's the subdivision of these Canaanites: the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, the Jebusites. So these are all pretty much the same people groups, the same larger people group, but all the major divisions of them. And the last one has to do with the city of Salem, or Jebus, or what it will eventually be called, Jerusalem. So they are mentioned specifically because of the future connection as the capital city of the Israeli people in the Promised Land. So after introducing that it is now time to fulfill the prophecy, God goes on to say this: "Now behold, the cry of the people of Israel has come up to me, and I have also seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppress them. Come, I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt." So he is being commissioned to go back and talk to the current Pharaoh, a man by the name of Thutmose III, who was only a baby whenever Moses had to run away. And then we find out, beyond a shadow of a doubt, Moses has moved on. Because instead of saying, "Behold the servant of the Lord," he says this, verse 11, "Moses said to God, 'Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the children of Israel out of Egypt?'" He says, "Why would I be the choice for that?" So he doesn't want the job. Verse 12, he said, "I will be with you, and this will be a sign for you that I've sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain." So God's first pushback against Moses' pushback is, "Moses, yes, you are the guy for the job, and I am guaranteeing you that you will bring those people back to this exact site for worship. I promise you that." But Moses is still in rejection phase. And when we don't really feel on board with something, we make excuses. And so here comes his first big one, which becomes the origin of the divine name of God, which we're going to spend some time on here in a moment. Verse 13, "Then Moses said to God, 'Well, if I do come to the people of Israel and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and then they ask me, well, what's his name? What should I say to them?'" Now, Moses is not just pulling this up out of nowhere. The Egyptian people are renowned for having a multitude of gods. They're not quite like, the whole gods in India thing, where they've got millions, but they got a lot. And each of them have their own little region or their responsibilities, and they've got signs and symbols attached to them. And the Israeli people have been exposed to these multiple gods of the Egyptian society for four centuries. And some of them have adopted those gods as their own. And we know that's the case because God complains in later Bible texts that they brought their gods and goddesses with them during their Exodus experience and worshiped them, although covertly, through the entire wilderness. And so Moses, aware of all of that, that many of the Israelites are now polytheists, says, "Well, you know, there's a lot of gods out there. Which god am I supposed to tell them is going to break them out?" And God famously said back to Moses in verse 14, "I am whom I am." So he uses the present tense form and the first person present tense form of the verb to be. I am whom I am. It said, you say this to the people of Israel, I am has sent me to you. And so a lot of people will say that the divine name of God is I am. And I'm going to make a slight tweak on that from the very beginning and teach you something that hopefully will make good sense. If you were a believer in that being the case, that God's divine name is Eyah, or in English, I am, and somebody asks you, hey, who's your God? And you answered, I am. Do you see a problem with that? I do this exercise in classes, and I see the light go off in their heads immediately when they have to formulate the answer, and they don't want to say it, because then it sounds like they're talking about themselves. Well, there's a solution for that. Look at verse 15. God also said to Moses, say this to the people of Israel. He who is the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Yitzhak, the God of Jacob, has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and thus I am to be remembered throughout all generations. So there in the quote from God in verse number 15, he starts off with the third person singular of the verb to be, which in Hebrew is Yahweh. Now, there is some variations in the central letter between ancient Hebrew and the more modern varieties, but it is basically YHWH. All consonants, no vowels. They put vowel sounds in when they used the language, but they didn't use it in their writing. So the divine name appears for the very first time in chronological history here in verse number 15, and is God that gives it. And he says, this is the name you guys are going to use. See, I am is the way God responds when the question is, who is God? But when people respond on God's behalf, they say, he is. Or as I like to say, he who is. And so why is it just Lord then in our text here? And there is a long drawn out explanation for that. I'm going to try to give you a speed read on it. The Israeli people, because of the commandment, you will not use the name of he who is your God in vain, eventually started avoiding pronouncing Yahweh out loud. Instead, they substituted Adonai, the Hebrew word for my Lord, in place of the divine name. When they eventually wrote the text and copied it and passed it down, and they developed vowel pointing, and this wasn't until the Christian era, by the way, the readers or the writers of those Hebrew texts put the vowel pointing for Adonai underneath the four letters for he who is. It wasn't to help in pronunciation of he who is. It was to help remind the reader, don't say the name of God here. Say Adonai. Now, in the time leading up to the Reformation, The European believers in Jesus rediscovered the Bible and started really getting involved in translating it. The Germans were really involved in it at first. And so they took the Hebrew text here, and they saw the divine name with its four consonants, but the little vowel points connected to it. And the German people saw the letters that we would call J, H, V, H. But they also saw the vowel pointing for E, O, and A. When the English translators got on board and started working with the texts of the Germans, they saw those same letters, and do you know what they saw? They saw the word Jehovah, when in fact, that was not what was intended, even by the Germans. If you're not aware, the letter that we think of in English as J actually has a Y sound. And the letter that looks like a V actually has a W sound. And so during that time period, that's where the name Jehovah comes into the English language. But it's totally an accident. And it definitely is not reflective of the actual text. But when these later translators finally settled down, they decided, you know what we ought to do? We ought to not use the divine name in the text. Let's just put special typeset of the word Lord to let people know, hey, this is where the divine name appears. As we close today, I recommend go to the introductory material of your own Bible, and you will find information explaining exactly that.